Moderator or co-moderator, and your first presenter, Michelle Mahoney. Michelle, whenever you're ready to begin, please do.
Okay, great. Thank you, Jean, for getting us all set up and ready to go for today's webinar on practical applications of phytotechnologies at contaminated sites. As Jean mentioned, my name is Michelle Mahoney. I'm with the US EPA in the Superfund program, working on technology assessment, and I'm co-presenting today with Mark Springer, who's also in the Superfund program in our environmental response team. We're very excited to be able to present this topic to you today. So I'm just going to give a little introduction to what phytotechnologies are, just to make sure everyone's a little oriented to the topic, and then Mark's going to go into way more detail and case studies into what some of the things that we've done within our contaminated sites programs here at EPA. So phytotechnologies have been used at these contaminated sites that exist throughout the United States and elsewhere. We're cleaning up these sites to protect human health and the environment. And basically, phytotechnologies are a set of techniques that we make use of plants to help them achieve these environmental goals. Some of the techniques will extract, degrade, contain, or immobilize pollutants in the soil, groundwater, and surface water, and other contaminated media. Phytoremediation is a technology that uses plants and vegetation to treat the contaminated soil, groundwater, sediment, and wastewater. In Superfund, we've seen that one of the main contaminants of concerns in which plants have been used to uptake out of the soil has been arsenic, and we're going to talk about that a little bit today on our session. I wanted to show you this table here with the different types of phytoremediation. As I mentioned in the previous slide, Mark's going to go into more detail of all of these mechanisms, but I just wanted to give a little introduction here that there are a number of different ways in which plants can help to remediate contaminated sites. One of the things that we use to help with establishing plant growth to be able to do phytoremediation is the application of soil amendments. And we do this to improve the soil quality and, as I mentioned, establish plant growth. It's complementary, and most of the times we find it's a necessary approach to support the use of phytotechnologies. There's a range of different types of soil amendments that are available to do this, and a lot of them are available locally where we'll be doing the cleanup. Some of the materials most commonly used are compost and biosolids. Basically, at these contaminated sites, you know, we find increased acidity, presence of heavy metals and other contaminants, high concentrations of salts, and these things all created an infertile environment in the soil for allowing for plant growth, and it also limits microbial activity in the soil and alters the physical properties of the soil. And that's why it's critical to revitalize the soil health and help in order to help restore that degraded ecosystem so that we can establish plants. And we find that soil amendments have been proven to assist with this need to improve the soil quality. And I wanted to share with you, and all of these are available in the related URLs associated with this webinar, which you'll see to the right of the presentation screen. We have a number of resources related to phytotechnologies, some of which explaining the topic to citizens if you're going to do this work at a, in a community. We also have a focus area on CLUIN, which we call EcoTools, which has links to all the soil amendments and the phytotechnology information that you see presented here. And then we also have some guidance on the soil bioavailability at contaminated sites that I thought would be of interest to the participants on today's webinar. And you'll, on that CLUIN EcoTools page, you'll also find links to pretty in-depth case studies that we've provided the details of what we've done at sites. And then we also have a guide on using soil amendments for revitalizing, remediating, and reusing sites. That will go into a lot more detail of the different types of amendments that are available and could be used for this type of work. And so with that, I want to turn the presentation over to our main presenter, Mark Sprenger, who is an environmental scientist in Superfund in the environmental response team, and he's going to go into a lot more detail on this topic.
Okay. Assume you can hear me?
Yes, you sound loud and clear.
Okay. As Michelle said, my name is Mark Sprenger. I'm in the environmental response team in the Superfund program. Basically, what I'm going to do is a presentation of going over the technologies from a perspective of a remediation technology, not from a purely technical perspective that you might get. And some of the other presentations that are done that are available in CLUIN and other places. I'm not going to go into the science so much as basically getting it to work, having a successful remediation project where you can get this and apply it and succeed. So with that, we're going to go through a list of terms. This has got one added to the previous table that Michelle showed. And the reason for going through this is that it's important to have clear communication of what you're doing with the phytoremediation. People hear what they think you said versus what you think you said. So terminology becomes very important in being very clear. And for example, with phytoremediation, if you said it phytoremediation, you may mean phytodegradation, that you're degrading, using plants to assist in degradation of the compounds, the contaminants that are present. But people may hear that you're doing hyperaccumulation, that you're accumulating the contaminant in the plants, and therefore they'll be concerned about a secondary exposure through consumption of the plants and use of the woody material, if it's a tree, things of that nature, when that isn't what you're doing at all. So making sure that everybody understands what you're trying to accomplish, what the plants are being used for, what the goals are, and what the expected outcomes are is very important. If it's not clear, experience has said it comes back to create confusion and usually at the most inopportune time. So we'll go through these. Phytodegradation. Specifically, you use that term when you're actually degrading the contaminant that you're trying to treat. You could extend it to a transformation, that it isn't mineralized to carbon dioxide and water, but is transformed to another compound that hopefully is less toxic or less mobile. But since you're talking about degradation and transformation, you're not talking about elements. You're not talking about metals. This is really, when you're doing phytodegradation, you're going to be talking about organic compounds, typically lower molecular weight compounds, although there is research and development on higher molecular weight compounds. Phytoextraction. This is you're extracting the contaminant, using plants to extract the contaminant from a media. That's typically going to be water or soil. Could be in the groundwater, if you can get to the groundwater, or it can be extracting the contaminant that is released in the soil from the solid matrix of the soil. You could extend this to wetland species. There's a little bit less in terms of phytoremediation in wetlands, but the concepts and some of the applications are identical in wetlands for sediment as well. Phytohydraulics. Basically, if you're using this, you're using the plants to change the movement of water subsurface. That can be as we'll see in an example, it can be to try and shift a groundwater plume and actually change the surface aquifer, change the migration of the contaminants, similar to using a pumping system. You could extend this also to the idea of using plants to prevent water from moving through a waste material. That would be in conjunction or similar to talking about an evapotranspiration cap, where you're going to put a soil layer over a contaminated media, and you're going to have the plants there in part to pull water out of that surface soil and stop water from penetrating and moving through that contaminated waste material. This would be in a landfill type situation, and would be very applicable to trying to work with keeping water from getting through mine tailings, for example, mining waste. Phytosequestration. This is one that can have a variety of applications, but fundamentally you're using plants to reduce the mobility of a contaminant. This could involve chemical reactions. It could involve simply binding. But you're sequestering it. You're stopping it, the mobility. You're trying to stop the contaminant from moving from one place to another, presumably where it currently is, and you're vegetating the area, using the plants. It's less of a problem, and you simply really need to stop it from moving to the next place over. For example, moving into a surface water body where it may become much more mobile, change chemical form, and create a real chemical risk. Phytostabilization. This is really just referring to the idea that you're going to use plants to stabilize a sediment or a soil so that it won't move. That could be either because it's dust generation or erosion. We use plants all the time to stabilize surfaces. It's one of the primary things we do in Superfund is to stabilize the site. If we cannot remove the contaminants or decide that it is not practical or advisable to do that, we could use plants. We want them to stabilize the surface. We don't want dust generation. We don't want erosion. We're going to use plants to stabilize that. This isn't anything particularly different than a normal situation on a uncontaminated soil, just a matter that we would be applying it, and we may not be putting a soil cap on top. We may simply do something, as Michelle pointed out, we may simply amend the material to make the surface material able to support plant community and stabilize things in place that way. Phytovolatilization, basically what it says, you're basically using the plants effectively as an air stripper. They're going to move the contaminants from subsurface. Typically, it's going to be a groundwater contamination issue in this instance. You want to get the contamination out of the groundwater, stop it from migrating, and you're willing to have it move into the atmosphere where it can either degrade, either through photodegradation or other processes. But your objective is to get it out of the subsurface groundwater where it is a problem, move it into the atmosphere. Rhizosphere degradation. The rhizosphere is a very complex area around the root zone of plants. It has a microbial and invertebrate community typically associated with it. Fungal community is typically associated with the rhizome. And in this instance, it's not so much the plant that you're utilizing. The plant needs to be there so that the rhizosphere is there. But it's all the stuff that's going on in the rhizosphere that's getting you your end goal, that's doing the degradation. Those microbial organisms are there. There's a complex interaction often symbiotic between the plants and that community that exists in and around the plants. That's what is actually going to be doing your work, is that community. But you need the plant, you need to support the plant, and you may need to select specific plants in order to get the rhizosphere that you need to do the degradation. So we have these seven different things. You could come up with additional breaking it apart. The whole objective of using the different terminologies is to ensure clear communication in the development of the project, clear understanding of what the goals are and what you're doing, so that you're not second-guessed later on, or somebody comes in later on and says, I didn't think you were doing that. You'll also recognize that these things overlap. It's hard to do photo volatilization if the contaminant isn't extracted in some way. So there's an overlap or a commingling of these different things in pretty much every phytoremediation project that you could think of or that are out there as examples. A number of these things are going on simultaneously. We try and take advantage of that simultaneous activity. But again, we need to go back and make sure that everything is clear as to what we're doing and why we're doing anything in particular, or using this type of phyto remediation process. So I'm going to go through a couple of case studies, and they're ones you may have seen before. And the point of doing them is not to give you an in-depth evaluation of how these studies were conducted and all the research and studies and verification that went into them. What I'm going to present is really just an overview, and then go through how the different technologies or aspects of phytoremediation were utilized in these particular case studies, and then highlight what was needed in order to make it successful in terms of site conditions and or contaminants. So the first one we're going to talk about is Jay Field at Aberdeen Proving Ground. This is a Department of Defense site. It was a waste disposal site, burning pit and waste disposal up until, I believe, the 1960s. A lot of the waste was from World War II era. And practices for disposal at that time were not what they are today, basically is open burning and a pit. They have a large number of contaminants in this area. It's not an extraordinarily large area. Volatiles along with a lot of other things. This is just a synopsis of some of them, and you can see some of the contamination is actually pretty high. In the PPM range, not parts per billion range. The contaminants in large part that were concerned that from the phytoremediation standpoint are the volatiles that were moving in the groundwater. This is a little hard to see. I'm not going to present the details of this, the groundwater basically is moving from northwest to southeast and then fanning out and intersecting the water body on either side. This area was on a peninsula going out into water bodies associated with Chesapeake Bay. And the objective was to pull back that plume from intersecting and daylighting into the surface water. They considered a number of technologies when they're looking at this area, as is appropriate. There isn't a tool that works for everything. You need to use multiple tools. Phytoremediation in all of its forms are individual tools that can be used for specific purposes. They talked about pump and treat, recirculating wells, hydrogen release compounds for chemical oxidation, degradation, natural attenuation, and phytoremediation. In fact, when they did the remedy, they pretty much used all of these in one form or another in different places to try and contain the contamination from this particular area. I'm going to focus only on the phytoremediation aspect, which was trying to stop the plume from daylighting into the surface water. They used hybrid poplar trees. One of the the issues with groundwater plumes is you have to get the plants to go down to the groundwater. Most trees and plants will have their roots near the surface because that's the vast majority of the water that they need is near the surface. Deep-rooted trees are not real common. Mostly roots are at the surface. If you go out into you're hiking and you go into forest and you see trees that are blown down, you'll see that a lot of those roots that are holding that tree up are in the upper foot or so of the soil. So with this instance, the contamination was down a ways, a few feet, and we needed to make the trees go down to that water supply, down to the plume. So what was done is they used basically a form, a concrete form, and planted the tree in the concrete form and augered down through the concrete form, or augered down in, made a pit, put the concrete form in, and then backfilled it with soil, and then planted the tree. So the tree could not send out roots until it got down to the base of that that form. It's a fiber material form. This is a photograph of one of them being excavated to look at how the tree was doing, of whether or not they were sending the roots down through the bottom of the form, and that's in fact what they're doing. And you can see that this was a relatively dry pit going down quite a ways. That we need, the need was to force the roots to go quite deep to get down to the contaminated layer. This figure illustrates several years into the project. Remember, you're going to plant, in this instance, you're planting trees that were relatively young. They were, I believe when they were planted, maybe as much as 10 feet high, but still quite small and not necessarily able to draw a lot of water because of their size. But over a few years, poplars grow very quickly. They grew, they expanded, and in fact, looking at the groundwater, they actually did create a cone of depression. If you can see on the figure, you see the trees were planted in basically a barrier for the direction that the groundwater plume was moving to pull it back, and in fact, it was documented that they did create a cone of depression around those trees, which then retarded the movement of that contaminated groundwater to the surface. One of the other questions within this then is, okay, what happens to the contaminants? Where did they go? I'm not going to go through this in any detail, but basically the message from this is that the contaminants are going to move based on their solubility and their KOC. Contaminants that were relatively large, like the one on the far left, which is a nitrobenzene, that basically went into the trees but stayed in the tree. If you look at something like TCE, a large part, which is the blue section, was volatilized out into the atmosphere, so we were doing phytovolatilization in that instance. So if you have more than one contaminant, they're not all going to do exactly the same thing in the same way. So what did they, from a phytoremediation standpoint at the J-Field site, what aspects of phytoremediation, what technologies were applied? Well, they did the phytohydraulics. That was the primary object. They didn't want to have to put in a barrier wall of wells and operate those wells and then treat that water and do things. The idea was we could plant the trees. They will draw enough water seasonally in order to create a cone of depression and retard the discharge of contaminated groundwater to a surface water body. And in fact, they did. That's the phytohydraulics. Phytoextraction, that was also an objective. It was a polishing step in many respects for the contaminants as they came out. The look at the trees and the investigation, the plants did take up, they did extract the contaminants along with the groundwater. Some of those contaminants were moved through the trees, and some of the was degraded with phytodegradation, which is the next one down. There is phytodegradation of some of the contaminants by the hybrid poplars. Certain ones do better than others. If you're going to go into this, you do need to look at the genotype and phenotype of the trees that you're getting. It's not just simply a matter of going to the local supplier of hybrid poplars and buying whatever is on their lot. They do need to be evaluated for their potential to actually do the degradation, and some do and some don't. It has to do with whether or not those enzyme systems are turned on or not within that particular strain of tree. Rhizosphere degradation, that was also occurring and documented. The plants were bringing the contaminants up, and there was documented degradation occurring within the rhizosphere as well as within the trees. And there are a number of presentations that you can find to go over the details of all the sampling and studies that were done to document all this, including then the last one, the phytovolatilization, where there was air stripping that occurred, particularly with the TCE, and that was documented by collecting the off-gassing from the leaves. So this is an example where there were at least five different phytotechnologies that were going on at one time. Certain ones were primary. The hydraulics was primary on this application, and the degradation was largely extraction and degradation was largely secondary. It was promoted, it was desired, but the primary goal was the altering the hydraulics. So what made J-Field work? As I said, you can find presentations on this. A lot of work was done on research demonstration of the technology when these were put in, and it was viewed as a large success. But why was it successful? Well, it's successful because the contamination was in a shallow aquifer. If the contamination was down too much deeper than what it was, we couldn't have forced the roots to go down and intersect that contamination. And if you can't get the roots to go down to the groundwater where the contamination is, then it isn't going to work. You're not going to extract it. You're not going to alter the hydraulics, and you're not going to extract the contaminants. So at the time, it was recognized you needed to force the trees down to send the roots deep. That was accomplished because that need was seen in the beginning. The contaminant levels weren't high enough to adversely affect the trees. That's important. If the contaminants were actually toxic to the trees, then the phytoremediation wouldn't have worked because the trees would have been impaired or died from the toxicity. So we can't have phytotoxicity. It worked because the contaminants of primary concern, the TCE in particular, so a soluble and degradable compound, and it can be translocated through plants. All contaminants are not translocated through plants. All contaminants are not necessarily degradable. Need to evaluate whether or not the contaminants you need to deal with have those characteristics in relation to the plants. The plants selected were largely selected for the high degree of transpiration. As I said, hybrid poplars, poplars in general, and a number of other trees take up a lot of water. Hydraulics was the primary goal, change in hydraulics. That's why they selected the poplars, because they pull a lot of water. Other trees could be used in other situations if perhaps the hydraulics isn't important, and you just need, and the contaminants are largely within the soil as opposed to being strictly or largely associated with the groundwater. So it's dependent on where the contaminants are and getting the plants in contact. And as I had mentioned, to make sure that the hybrid poplars had the degradation system turned on and that there was correct phenotype. They went through and did that early work. At the time that this was initiated, that was only becoming recognized that you could have hybrid poplars and get them and plant them, and some had showed signs of degradation and others did not. And at that point, it was recognized that you had to pay attention to not just that it's a hybrid poplar, but what strain of hybrid poplar. The next case study is one you, again, you see a number of examples. Michelle mentioned this, the Chinese brake fern and arsenic. Okay, this was a site that was done as a removal action by EPA in Virginia. The situation was that the area had been a orchard at one time, an apple orchard, and they had used arsenical-based compounds on the orchard as a pesticide. The area was currently wooded, and slopes, so we don't have a flat ground surface. It's large trees, a difficult area to work. And it was from historical farming, apple orchards. The soil contaminations were not extraordinarily high, but certainly elevated, around 50 to about 111 parts per million in the surface soils. And at the time for this particular site, the goal was that the soil should not exceed 58 parts per million. This is currently a residential area, and they came to the conclusion that 58 parts per million was going to be their goal to get to that level. Also, there was a limited acreage that had contamination that needed to be dealt with. So we have a number of starting conditions. A couple of things, the Chinese brake fern in a growing season is going to be able to get to around 40 to 50 milligrams per kilogram dry weight arsenic in the tissue, and it's going to take arsenic from about a 1 foot square foot area. That's basically the root zone around a fern. So that's its zone of influence, about a square foot per plant. And it's going to be able to take up that concentration of about 40 to 50 milligrams per kilogram. I don't have an exact mass on dry mass on a brake fern at the end of a growing season, but it is not a extraordinarily heavy plant once you dry it out. So you can see you're extracting on the order of something like a gram or so of arsenic from a square foot area, okay? Which doesn't necessarily sound like a lot, but it can be significant over time. The goal was to reduce the soil arsenic levels without major disruption to the landscape. People didn't want their hillside and their property disturbed. In order to remove the contamination from these areas, what would have had to have been done is to go in and cut down the mature trees and basically clear the landscape, and then do soil removal and haul all that soil and and trees, mature trees, out for disposal. People didn't want the landscape disturbed, and there was concern about a large amount of truck traffic over residential roads to actually do this. There was estimates of around 60 to 70 trucks of soil removal, as opposed to maybe one or two trucks for the plant removal a year when it was taken down. If you're interested in this, the site, there's a YouTube video that's available, and there is contact information and link information that's provided on that. That will show you the planting and the entire aspects of going through and doing the actual project. So what was applied? Well, this was phytoextraction. Not really anything else. It was phytoextraction. The idea was to extract the arsenic from the soil accumulated in the plant and then harvest the plants and dispose of them and decrease the arsenic level within the soil over time in a relatively slow but low-impact type process. Why did it work? Because it was viewed as a success. Well, one, the climate in the area of Virginia is conducive to Chinese brake fern. It's a non-native species. It prefers southern climates. It's not going to survive over winter, so we have to be replanted. The farther north you go, the shorter the growing season, the less effective it may end up being. It could be very effective if in certain instances, but climatic conditions do make a difference. They also had an irrigation system readily available because it was in a residential area, so that they could ensure that the ferns, when they were planted, did not dry out and die. As with any plantings, if you do home gardening, you have to make sure at least initially that there is water for them until they get their root system going. Contamination was at the surface. This was surface contamination from pesticide application. So it was only the very top surface of the soils that were contaminated. And that's the area that needed to be remediated. Didn't require getting down into subsurface layers. The contamination levels were above acceptable risk range, but they weren't source-level material. They weren't high enough to hurt the plants. They weren't high enough. Arsenic can impact fungal communities, which is one of the pests that was used to control. So the levels were not very high. They were low, high enough to be a problem, but low enough that going in and simply removing the contaminants was not necessarily an economically a viable thing to do, as well as the disruption to the area. Removing the soil, as I said, the contamination was in the surface soil, in the very surface, but you can't remove just the surface soil from a remediation perspective. You are forced to almost take, especially in a slope setting, probably a foot if you can get it, and if there's a bedrock in the area or it's rocky, it gets even harder to get that surface material off to do anything. Remediation is typically heavy equipment, bulldozers, excavators, things of that nature. It's not shovels and small earth-moving tools. It's moving large amounts, and moving large amounts of those large pieces of equipment can't cut at a 6-inch level for the most part, especially on slopes. Excuse me. So the landscape wasn't conducive to excavation. One, because the contamination didn't go that deep, and two, the slopes, the foresting, and everything would have worked against you and increased the cost dramatically in order to do a traditional removal approach. Okay, the last case study I'm going to do is a site called Sharon Steele. This is in outside of Sharon, Pennsylvania. There's a lot of Sharon Steele sites across the country. This one is, as I said, in western Pennsylvania. It was a iron steel production facility, and they produced large amounts of different types of sludges and slags and liquors that were disposed of over a large area. The site covers around 330 acres, including about 100 acres of wetland. The vast majority of that area is physically impacted because it's slag material, which has no real properties of that a real soil would have, as well as an altered pH. The material is erodible. Water percolates through it and moves, and there can be dust generation that would also occur. So, and those were kind of the primary problems. Is the stuff with these piles were not particularly stable. They disrupted the landscape. There was dirt biking that occurred on these properties, as you might expect, which generated dust. High winds and stuff could generate dust and blow the contaminants off-site, and we needed to stabilize the areas. So a ROD was signed, and that ROD included grading of areas because of steep slopes, consolidating some material, and then capping the steel slag with sludge with biosolids to enhance the cap. So we're doing, as Michelle indicated, using soil amendments and soil amendment technology to create conditions for the phytostabilization. The Shenango River is nearby. Again, that needed, there is a concern of migration of contaminants through erosion of soils or the slag material, as well as migration through contaminated groundwater. Its water would percolate through the contaminants. So the technology is applied. It's really a stabilization. We wanted to stabilize the material in place so that it wasn't eroding and moving either to the surface water bodies, the wetland, the river, or dust is blown to reach human receptors. There aren't a lot of residences in the immediate vicinity, but the area is being developed, and you don't have to go too far before you can get to hotels and things of that nature. So it was largely a stabilization effort. And you could argue that there's some sequestration that would be occurring as well. So why did it work? Well, actually, they're still in the process of implementing this. But the alternative for stabilizing this area would be to bring in a soil cover of some kind. I don't know if they would have went all the way to putting down a clay cap and then soil, but then you would be planting it, and as we would be, with as was proposed, but we'd have to bring in all that material, all that soil. The original estimates were the difference between the two approaches of bringing in a soil cover versus amending the material and stabilizing with plants was on the order of $40 million difference. It worked because this was a physical movement problem of soil, either because of the wind or the water. Those were the exposure pathways, and it worked in part because the contaminants weren't very large and prominent human health contaminants. This is iron slag and iron waste from steel production. So it does have contaminants in it, but it's not like a hard rock mining situation where you'd have high levels of zinc and cadmium and lead and things of that nature. This is more high iron and higher base metals like calcium, magnesium, altered pH. It had actually a very high pH. I think pH at times is around 12. So the contaminant makeup of it made simple stabilization a very viable mechanism to remediate potential exposures from the contaminants that did exist. So we're going to go through now each of the technologies and just sort of run through just a list of what conditions do you need to have in order for these to really be useful for your particular site, and make sure that these conditions or considerations actually occur if you want to try and apply these. So for phytodegradation, one, the plants have to be tolerant of the concentrations of the contaminants. You can't be at concentrations that cause phytotoxicity, or it's not going to work. If it's degradation, you need the contaminants have to be able to be taken up by the plant. Some contaminants aren't taken up by the plant. They may get absorbed to the surface of the root and not move, but they're not actually taken up by the plant. And if the plant's going to do the degradation, it has to get into the plant. The plants have to be able to extract the contaminant from the soil matrix or get it from the groundwater. There has to be a mechanism that they can extract it and get it into the system. That goes hand in hand with they taking up the contaminant. Then you also have to check to make sure that the plant that you're using can actually degrade the contaminant. And as I said before, with the hybrid poplars, it was discovered that not all hybrid poplars would actually degrade. They would take it up, they would do the volatilization, but they wouldn't actually do degradation. So that has to be verified that, one, the contaminant can be degraded, and two, that the plant can actually do the degradation. It would be nice, not required, but it'd be nice that it's a non-invasive species. People will have a lot of heartburn if you want to put out a species that is going to just take off into the environment. Chinese brake fern is not going to survive in North America, or at least the northern latitudes of North America. So we don't have a problem with that becoming an invasive species and getting out from our remediation out into the environment. There may be good candidates for doing phytodegradation, but the plant is invasive, and then you're not going to use it, or you're going to have controls to stop it from getting away from you, which is often hard to do. The plant needs to be appropriate to the local climate. The Chinese brake fern is an example. It is more amenable to southern climates and northern climates for the growing season. And a lot of the other trees that we have across the country and other plants do have climatic restrictions. So you have to make sure that you're in the right spot for the right plant, the same way you would be for gardening. And this, in many respects, is like gardening, or that's an underpinning to this. And it would be very good if this plant that you're using is tolerant of adverse environmental conditions. Why? Because a lot of times, or in many instances, the place where you need to put those plants is not ideal. You take the Sharon steel, you have a very high pH soil that has poor water holding capacity, low nutrients. That is not ideal growing conditions. So you want something that is fairly resilient if you can do it. And you'll see as I go through, there's a lot of redundancy here. So for phytoextraction, what do you need? You need the tolerance of the plant species. They can't be adversely affected by the contaminants. They have to take up the contaminant. It would be nice if they were hyper accumulators, People talked about doing hyperaccumulation for lead with mustard for a long time, and there was a lot of work to try and do phytoextraction and hyperaccumulation of lead using mustard plants. In the end, it was largely unsuccessful. The reason it was unsuccessful is not because mustard cannot hyperaccumulate lead. It's a matter of, in order to get the soil conditions so that the mustard plants would grow well, because they have to grow well in order to do the extraction, you often needed to fertilize the soil. But in fertilizing the soil, you changed the availability of the lead, and the lead was no longer available to the plant for accumulation. So we had competing problems with getting the technology to work. And in fact, the fertilization, the use of phosphate fertilizer, is in fact a remediation technology for lead in soils when we do soil amendment as the approach for lead contamination in soils. So we had two different things working against each other for that example. There are hyperaccumulators out there that accumulate large amounts. Chinese breakout fern is probably in the moderate level of accumulation, which doesn't mean it'll fail. You just have to have enough accumulation occurring to meet the goal that you're trying to achieve. As with the other, it needs to extract the contaminant from the matrix, or you won't get the extraction. And again, the non-invasive species, if possible, appropriate to the local climate and tolerant of environmental conditions. If you have to amend things so much, you may end up doing primarily an amendment project rather than a phytoremediation project, which isn't bad. It's just a matter of being clear what you're doing and what is accomplishing your goals. Phytohydraulics, again, tolerant of the contaminants. You want a high evapotranspiration rate. You want plants that pull a lot of water. So they're going to either have to have very deep roots, or they're going to be in places where they have a fair amount of water, because plants that volatilize a lot of water need a lot of water. They need access to the water. So those two things are going to be competing a little bit, but you want a plant that has a high evapotranspiration rate, because you want to pull water out and pull it from the subsurface, get it into the atmosphere. Again, non-invasive if possible, appropriate to a local climate. For phytohydraulics in particular, this is going to be a long-term thing. They need to survive year-round. You aren't going to be replanting every season. Ideally, or practically, like the example of Jayfield, it took several years for those plants to get to the size where the hydraulics was sufficient to start actually altering the surface aquifer. It didn't happen the first year. It took several years for those plants to get large enough to be pulling enough water and transpiring enough water in order to meet the objective. Tolerant of the environmental conditions, again, extensive root system. If you want to pull water, you need an extensive root system and a high growth rate, because those are things that are going to be, it's going to grow fast, get to the point where it can be pulling the water that you need it to be pulling. You need to know how much water you need to pull in order to create that cone of depression and figure out how many plants you need and how much they're going to be pulling out in order to get this to work effectively. And not have unrealistic expectations. So you need a large root system and pull a lot of water, preferably high growth rate, and again, tolerant of the conditions. Sequestration, standard, tolerant of the concentration of the contaminants, ability to take up the contaminant, or capacity to release exudates to stimulate microbial growth and are required for the transformation. Exudates are the things that plants push out of the root systems. Plants don't always just pull water in. They move water in and out. because they're trying to get nutrients and the things that they need out of the soil. And they don't necessarily come out of the soil just on their own into the plant. So the plants actually push water and other compounds, which are referred to as exudates, out into the root zone, largely or commonly in the evening, and then during the day when the evapotranspiration increases, then they pull that all back in with all the nutrients that they want and minerals that they want. So that back and forth can be influential in sequestering and immobilizing contaminants. Again, the last was three are the ones we've said before: non-invasive, appropriate to climate, tolerant of adverse conditions, and then for sequestration, again, we'd like a large root system. Not all plants have a big root system, but some of them do, and paying attention to the size and how the roots grow from the particular species you're looking at is a valuable thing to look at. Stabilization. Again, tolerant of contaminants if they're present at the surface, non-invasive, appropriate to the climate, tolerant of the environmental conditions. We would like an extensive root system and high growth rate. Why? Because we want those plants to grow, get established, and create that stabilization cover that holds that soil in place and does not allow wind erosion or water erosion. And then tolerant of the environmental conditions. Volatilization, this is going to be applicable only to volatile compounds. If they're not a volatile compound, they're not going to be translocated and volatilized out the leaves, which is where the volatilization would occur. Again, the tolerant of the contaminants, able to take up the contaminant, or they can't translocate it. They have to be able to extract it or pull it from the soil matrix or the water column. And for phytovolatilization, that's likely to be cases where it's the contaminants are relatively water-soluble and they're in the surface groundwater rather than extracted from the soil, but there could be instances where they'd be extracted from the soil. The plants have to be able to translocate those contaminants through the plant. As you saw with the example in Jayfield, some compounds are taken up by the plant, but they're not very effectively translocated. They either move into the woody tissue or they and sit there or absorb onto the roots. So if you want it to be volatilized, you want it to be this biological pump and trace system, you have to make sure that the contaminants can be moved through the plant systems, through the xylem and or phloem system. And then be volatilized out the roots. They have to be able to move through the roots, up the stems and woody body if it's a woody tree, and then out the leaves. So the translocation is important. You want a high evapotranspiration rate because you're trying to that's your efficiency. So it's not much different than the hydraulics. You want a large amount of movement occurring. And that's going to be driven by evapotranspiration. So it's going to be water movement. As with the others, you want it non-invasive, appropriate to the climate, tolerant of the environmental conditions. You'd like the root system to be extensive and high growth rate, again, because that's going to increase the efficiency and the time to when the volatilization will be effective, and tolerant of the environmental conditions. Rhizosphere degradation, again, you need tolerance to the contaminants. This may be more than just tolerance of the plant species, because remember the rhizosphere is a complex community of the microbial community, the fungal community, and probably some of the invertebrate community, both microinvertebrates and macroinvertebrates. Nematodes and things of that nature. Are all in that rhizosphere community. All of those, or at least the ones important for the degradation, have to be tolerant of the contaminants. You would like to have an extensive root system and high growth rate. Why? because that's going to give you the greatest efficiency and area coverage. Think back to the Chinese brake fern. It only does 1 square foot. That's because it's a relatively small plant. But you have to think about the size of that root system of the area that is that you have the degradation occurring, just like with the extraction. You have to think about the size of the root zone relative to the area you're treating, and there has to be overlap of the root zones. Again, like the other ones, non-invasive, appropriate to the climatic conditions, tolerant of adverse conditions, and I think I got that twice there. So there are lots of other resources to look at specific examples. I refer you to the Chinese brake fern. There's a nice video on that. There is an additional webinar on phytoremediation, which I'd encourage you to look at. It went into many more technical details than I did. I tried to hit the aspects of phytoremediation for implementation of a remedy technology that would be successful, and what things need to be to exist or occur in order for a successful remediation to occur. And here's additional contact information. And I will answer questions if people have them.
Great. Thanks, Mark. Yes, we did get a number of questions that came in during your presentation. So I think we can, you know, pause here and try to answer some of those and maybe direct people to some other resources. We did get a question about resources that just came in. Someone wanted to know if there's documents that list the application considerations, what the plants can do, and contaminants they can act on. I know the phytotechnology resources that we presented touches some of those topics, and also the previous presentation that we did a couple months ago that Mark mentioned was with a professor, I believe, from Harvard, who had written a book on plants and what they can do, so that would be a good resource. And I think it also talked about contaminants, but is there anything else that you can think of to refer them to, Mark?
I don't know that there's a lot else that is in a consolidated one place. Phytoremediation is gone through cycles, and there is in different applications. If you're looking, unfortunately, I don't think there is a consolidated one-stop shopping to get stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
I know there is information that was generated through the petrochemical industry, looking at use of plants at gas stations and things of that nature for small spill type situations. A lot of it is dispersed out there. Unfortunately, I think that book you mentioned, which I can't remember the title off the top of my head, but I know it's in that webinar, is probably a good place to start. And then you have to do a little searching.
Yeah, I was also, we just received a comment from a participant reminding us that ITRC also has a phytotechnology document and contains a database of species that can be used for phyto and associated contaminants. So that's another resource, is the ITRC. And these resources, if you go to clue in on the phytoremediation, phytotechnologies focus area, we do list all of these resources and then some. As we find them, we keep adding to it. We also have our own database of sites that we try to track, sites where we know that phytotechnologies have been attempted. The information, you know, may not be up to date as of today, but meaning that they may not actually currently be using phytotechnologies at those sites anymore, but at least it's a documentation of something that was attempted there with points of contact.
Yeah, one other point is that when you go, for those of you who are going to follow up on this and look at these things and going into things. Do pay attention to the details of what is done. There's a lot of really good research that's been going on over the years on a lot of compounds. But they, all of those are not at the ready for full-scale remediation stage. And I just caution everyone to look at the technology and look at what is being done carefully to make sure that it is applicable to your situation, and you're going to get this to be successful. Phytoremediation is a wonderful tool, and it has great applications. It also, if it isn't done carefully, can appear not to work at all, and that's not a good thing for anybody.
Right. Just another note on resources, a couple more comments that have come in. The book that we were referring to is called Phyto by Kate Kennan. And like, as we mentioned, we did deliver a webinar with her and one of her colleagues a couple months ago, and all of these are archived on the Cluin webpage. Again, you can search on the Phyto Technologies section of Cluin. And then another resource that's available is the International Journal of Phytoremediation and the International Phytotechnology Society. So these are places where you can find information on research and what's being done around the world. So let's see, let's get into some specific questions here. A lot of the questions you were answering as you continued on your presentation. So we did get a question about, like, I guess, planting density. This particularly came in when you were talking about the poplars, if there was any thoughts to share on an optimum density for planting them.
That would be on a case-by-case with plant basis of how closely you can crowd them and still grow. The in the J-Field instance, which I was lucky enough to actually go down during the project. It wasn't my project, but I was able to go down there and assist at least one or two times. Those were not, obviously, because you're growing trees and eventually they were going to be 30, 40 feet tall. You couldn't plant those right next to each other. You had to plant them at a density that was consistent with the size that you wanted them to be. And since they were, they had to get to that size to get their roots down into that aquifer to be effective and have the transpiration rate, it made no sense to plant a higher density in the interim. Because and then call down to the density as they got bigger, because until they got a certain size, they weren't going to be nearly as effective. So all you would be doing is actually slowing down the growth rate of the trees that you wanted in the end by increasing the plant density. On the Chinese brake fern, the person who asked, I would strongly suggest you look at the video that goes and shows the actual planting of the Chinese brake fern, and that they went through and figured out that they were only treating about one square foot, and then so they had to plant on a 1 square foot grid and plant those trees across that area. So it's a combination of you know, what is the size of the plant in the case of like the poplars, that you want them to be very effective at doing what you want them to do, and see if you can maximize that density. There's a number of just straight engineering things that are, you know, how much water you get, estimates, how much water do you need to move in order to effectively alter that surface aquifer? How much water are those plants going to be able to transpire at a certain sizes? Those were all things that were carefully considered and thought through, and actually in the demonstration of the work at Jay Field and Aberdeen Proving Ground, those things were all measured. They measured sap flow. They measured transpiration off the leaves. They put Kevlar bags over leaves during the day to capture the off-gassing and then measure the TCE coming in the off-gas to verify that there was volatilization of the contaminants through the system. All of that is available, although I don't know that it's available in one place. But there were, I think there were a number of publications that were done on Jay Field. And the, I believe that exists in at least one of the books on phytoremediation has a section specifically on the Jay Field example.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what I heard you say, Mark, is for the Chinese brake ferns, they can... they have the ability to extract it down to a foot into the soil. That's their depth.
The depth is shallower. I'm not sure the exact depth, but I think it's only about 6 inches. But they, the root zone is about a foot. So you get the planting density was on a 1 square foot grid node base.
Okay.
That gave you the root zone coverage over the entire area. Because you didn't care in that instance, you didn't care about the above ground portion. You were harvesting the above ground portion as part of the remediation, but that wasn't important. And what was important is how big the root zone was, because that's what was in contact with the soil. And they have a larger root area than they do above ground area.
Gotcha. So another question that came in, and I don't know that we talked about this too much, was just, so you're growing these plants that are accumulating contaminants. What are the concerns about, you know, preventing animals such as deer or others from eating these plants? And are there any controls or what considerations go into that?
That's one we deal with all the time, not only on phytoremediation, but on soil amendments, because there is going to be accumulation for a soil amendment type scenario where you're using the plants then to stabilize the area. It could be a native community or it could be a specific monoculture. It's going to accumulate. There's the line that is used is there going to be an attractive nuisance?
Yeah.
Are things going to come in and eat these things and get a high enough exposure? That's something that needs to be evaluated on a situation by situation, what the contaminant is, what plant are you using, and what would be consuming those plants. In the case of Chinese brake fern, I don't know that there is much that eats Chinese brake fern. If you're growing other things, just other plants, like in a Sharon Steele type situation, there needs to be an evaluation of whether or not there is any contaminant in particular that is going to accumulate to a point of being a problem. Typically, that's not going to be the case. Usually, or at least my experience has been, that where phytoremediation is applicable, the contaminant levels are not high enough to accumulate to a point where they're going to be a problem to a consumer of the plant. If there's going to be a problem, it's the plant that's going to have the problem. And if there's a problem with exposure from the contaminant in the soil, more often than not, it's the exposure to the soil, even to the animal, that's the problem, not the accumulation in the plant, then to the animal. Now, that isn't always going to be the case, my experience has been that in the places where this is applicable, that's likely to be the case. Remember, we're not doing phytoremediation, at least for soil contamination, in the source area. Now, the J field situation, we're kind of in the source for TCE, but TCE doesn't concentrate anyplace. It's degraded. So if you got a compound that's degrading, it's not going to accumulate to a point where it's going to be a dietary exposure problem. So it's an interplay between the degradation, the amount of concentration that might occur in the plant, and what the source, what the initial contamination level is. And as I said, repeat it again. Most instances where we would be using a phytoremediation technology, we would not be in an area where we would expect a secondary exposure problem to occur because of the phytoremediation, although it always does need to be looked at.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that, at least from the sites that I've seen that we've studied and documented.
And remember, if you're doing stabilization too, that should be you should be stabilizing it such the exposure isn't occurring. So the objective is to stabilize it so exposure doesn't occur, and therefore you should not be enhancing exposure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did you see any concentrations of TCE that were toxic to the hybrid poplars?
No, a lot of organic contaminants are not particularly toxic to plants. Obviously, some are. We have herbicides, but a lot of other contaminants have to be really high in order to be adversely affect the plant. Now, they could affect the rhizome community, but not necessarily the plant. And in the instance in Jay Field, I'm not aware of any evidence from any of the studies conducted that there was an adverse effect on the plant, and there was little evidence of sequestration in the plants, although there were a few compounds like the nitrobenzene that did go into the woody tissue and didn't very effectively move out or degrade, although that would degrade over time. There mm-hmm. may be a consideration depending on the contaminant and looking at it on ultimately the disposal of the trees once they get old enough to die, very similar to the disposal of the Chinese brake fern.
Yeah. Another good question that came in here, so are there any bench tests that can be used to determine, which phytotechnology application would work best for a situation?
I think there's a lot of examples out there that you could weed through and figure out your short list. And then for something like the Chinese brake fern, if you're going to do a phytoextraction, it's harder to do for some of the volatiles, but if it's a non-volatile compound, you would be well served to do a bench scale test to determine whether or not the contaminant is effectively accumulated, extracted, and whether or not there's anything that an amendment that you need to add or perhaps exclude because it interferes. All of the work or a lot of the work that was done on mustard with lead accumulation, a lot of that was laboratory-based work, bench-scale type mm-hmm. work. And as you know, Michelle, when we do amendment studies, we like to be able to do a bench scale evaluation, which gives you more ideal conditions and tells you whether or not the technology is going to have a chance at working in the field. bench scale study doesn't guarantee it's going to work in the field because conditions are very different in the field than they are in a pot in a greenhouse
right.
or under a light. The soil is sieved and all sorts of things, ample water. But if you can't get it to work on a bench scale, you're unlikely to get it to work in the field.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And Mark and I have done quite a few presentations on Cluin and case studies and other documents that you can find in the seminar resources, particularly at that EcoTools page. There's a whole section on soil amendments. And since we're talking about that, and I, you know, this wasn't necessarily a presentation about soil amendments themselves, but we did get a couple questions just about contaminants or potential contamination in using something like biosolids. Can you just talk a little bit about that and how we, you know, do careful analysis of those materials before we would use any of them?
Yeah, there's a lot of consternation about biosolids. A lot of it has to do with, from public perception, has to do with pathogens. And the short answer is that's an easy one to deal with because the biosolids you use and that kind of application are pathogen-free, and they're treated so they are pathogen-free. Worry about surface waters and things going to surface water. There's regulations that you have to use composted material that's stabilized so that you aren't going to influence nutrient loading to surface water bodies and those kinds of things. Then we have the traditional contaminants. There are much, much, much lower contaminants in today's municipal biosolids than was the case 20, 30 years ago. A lot of the stuff that's still out there and people still look at and say, look at how much is in there, is really not what's in there any longer. Industrial discharges into municipal water treatment systems is maybe not a thing of the past, but it's not what it was. There's all pretreatment from industrial discharges, so the loading of all metals and a lot of other things isn't what it was 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You do have all the household stuff, and there is a fair amount of consternation about that, about personal care products and things of that nature. The only thing I could say is that in the projects that I've been involved in, there's been a lot of effort to evaluate that. It's not easy to do because a lot of those compounds are difficult to analyze for because you're analyzing for them in extremely small concentrations. They're not routine compounds to analyze for, so it becomes extraordinarily expensive to try and do that as a routine basis as opposed to analyzing for cadmium, lead, zinc, cobalt, nickel, and a variety of metals or or pesticides. To date, I have not seen a soil amendment project that in the end the determination was that those compounds were at high enough of a level to make the project not viable. Those are the ones that are going to be those personal care product type things are the ones that are the most problematic in terms of saying anything definitive. All the traditional things, we're either treating a contaminant at a much higher level than it's in the biosolids, or we're immobilizing stuff, so those aren't the problem. I think that's about as definitive as I can be, is that I've not seen a project stopped with a hard piece of information says, no, this is going to create an environmental problem, but there is a lot of public concern.
Right. Yeah, and as I mentioned, you know, Mark has given quite a few presentations on this topic, and you can find those archived on CLUIN. So I would encourage you to check those out if you want to learn more about some of these projects that we've worked on, at least in Superfund and other contaminated sites. So we're coming up to about the time we're scheduled to end here. Mark, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to present with us today. It was really a pleasure to do this with you, and I'm very grateful. So thank you.
Thank you, and I hope everyone got something out of this.
Yes, definitely. So with that, I think I'm going to turn the reins back over to Gene Balance, who is going to close us out for today's session.
Okay, sorry about that. Thank you so very much, Michelle. We're going to go ahead and move right along with our closing reminders for today's broadcast. As we noted at the start of today's session, you can connect with us via a few vehicles. One of the most popular ways that people use to stay on top of our latest internet seminars, once we make them available, is to follow us or to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, TechDirect, which you can receive for free by email. It comes out on the first of each month, so I strongly encourage you to visit us at CLUIN.org and sign up for TechDirect so you can learn about these new webinars as soon as we have them. We do also have copies of the presentation materials that were discussed in today's session, and a variety of the links and resources that were mentioned on today's presentation are already posted there, as well as including some of the resource videos that were highlighted. If you're looking for contact information for our presenters and organizers, I'll just remind everyone you'll find that on the seminar homepage. And I'll ask each of you to please spend just a moment filling out our very brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the format that we followed as well as the content that we covered today. If you happen to participate in a group, each one of you can fill out the feedback form individually. One of the most frequent questions we receive are individuals who are looking for certificates or CEUs or PDHs. We don't offer those particular credit hours, so there are no CEUs or PDHs given out for these webinars, but you can download or print out a participation certificate to save for your own records. If you fill out the online feedback form and look very carefully at the bottom of that feedback form, there's a box you can check which certifies you were here for the entire session, or if you're watching the recorded version, you can check it and mark that you replayed the entire thing. Once you check that box and submit the feedback form, you'll immediately have access to a participation certificate that you can download or print out. Again, each of you, if you shared a line as a group in a room, can fill out that feedback form on your own to get your own participation certificate. And as I noted earlier at the start of today's session, our broadcast was recorded. You will automatically receive an email with a link on replaying today's session, or you can visit us at CLUIN.org and browse through our over 700 previously recorded webinars that we have on our live archive page. So with that, I'd like to echo Michelle's thanks to the over 130 individuals who chimed in for today's live session, as well as Michelle and Mark for sharing their expertise on our broadcast. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live session. Thank you so very much.